Welcome back to the Talking Hedge. I'm Josh Kincaid, capital markets analyst and host of your cannabis business podcast. My guest today, Mark Sims, CEO of Riv Capital. Mark, thanks again for being back on the Talking Hedge.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. So Riv Capital, you guys are an investment acquisition company specializing in the cannabis industry. You were on the podcast before, so just kind of jumping off the last conversation we have about Riv Capital previously announcing that you guys entered a definitive agreement with the Hawthorne Collective. That's a cannabis focused subsidiary of Scott's Miracle-Gro. That's kind of where you came from. You got some experience out there. So I am curious about where you think the home grow segment is at. If you've got an opinion about that, where you think the projections are for home grow right now?
Yeah, I haven't been as close to it recently. I know, you know, the Hawthorne, they finished their fiscal year back in October, definitely had a challenging year, I think, which is a reflection of so much, you know, kind of biomass out on the market. And so I think, you know, the home growers, you know, both, I'll call them the true hobbyists, the folks that you know, just grow for themselves and maybe a couple friends. I think that continues to be, a strong segment. Again, it's small scale. The, I'll call them the traditional growers, right? So the quote unquote hobbyists that maybe grow for themselves as well as for fun and profit. I think that's the piece that's gotten the most impacted by this kind of oversupply situation that we're in. So I think a lot of those folks are probably on the sidelines, not making a lot of purchases to expand what they're doing, and or, you know, have maybe kind of folded up their tent, just given kind of the state of the markets.
Mm-hmm. So Hawthorne Collective, they gave or they allowed $150 million for investment. I'm curious how Riv has invested that money.
Yeah, so again, you know, so Riv themselves had a pile of capital. About 18 months ago, you know, Riv and Scott's Miracle-Gro, they had been, you know, talked previously about potential different ways they could work together. But there was kind of high alignment on a strategy to enter the U.S. And have a brand-focused strategy. So Scott's provided $150 million in through a convertible note instrument to the Riv Capital team. And then that was going to be used in combination with the other capital that they had to execute a transaction in the U.S. And so that's what really kind of was a precursor to the Etain acquisition in New York. And so, you know, not to get too much in the weeds, but the unique thing is, you know, the Hawthorne funds were quote unquote restricted. So they couldn't be used for like OPEX or CAPEX of a plant touching company. But to actually buy the shares or buy out the owners of a plant touching company, that was an allowable use for the cash. And so really, you know, the majority of their cash all went to fund the Etain transaction in New York.
Gotcha. When you guys are deciding and looking at acquiring cannabis companies, what is kind of that methodology? What do you guys go through?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so again, kind of the, what we're looking for in kind of, you know, what are the target states, if you will? Unfortunately, we got to go state by state, as you know. And so it's really, from our perspective, it was kind of, you know, a couple criteria. One was large state. So, you know, go to where the people are, which is kind of a no-brainer. Limited license. So again, a situation where you're, you know, potentially going to have an opportunity to compete and win in a somewhat limited licensed environment. And then kind of another piece would be the, you know, what is the cultural significance of that particular locale, right? So when we think about New York, why that was so attractive is obviously it's large, it's limited license, and, you know, kind of the high focus on social equity, I think is going to be really good long-term for the state industry. But it also has, you know, it has a huge both national and global influence when you think about, you know, how many trends, how many brands, how many companies kind of get their foothold and kind of take root in New York. And then they use that as the place to kind of grow from within the Northeast, within the country, and then globally, given, you know, there's 20 plus million New Yorkers, but there's also 150 million visitors that come to the state every year.
Yeah, definitely see that in the fashion industry for sure. But as you're looking at these companies, valuations are a little bit crazy right now. Multiples always kind of have been. Right now, when you're still looking to expand or acquire, are these valuations at this point mark to market? Are they crashing too fast to determine, like, where are they at?
Yeah, so it's a couple different things. One is I think if it's a private company that you're looking to maybe deploy some growth capital into, I think you need to look at like where the current market is trading. So, you know, what are the revenue multiples? What are the EBITDA multiples? And those, to your point, kind of vary day to day, week to week. I think as it relates to, and as we look at potential opportunities for combinations, and, you know, as I've kind of stated previously publicly, that's definitely something that RIV is looking at. We obviously have a great asset in New York. We have, you know, over $100 million in capital that we can deploy. And so I think that's, you know, makes us an interesting and attractive partner for folks that aren't in New York and maybe need growth capital. I think that's really a situation where, you know, if it's either it's a public or a private, I think part of the challenge is how do you stack up, like, what are the assets that people are bringing to the table? I think it's harder to do on, you know, looking at the current share price and or looking at, you know, kind of current multiples. I think it's really looking at what are the assets you're bringing to the table and what's kind of the relative split of the value of those assets and liabilities, right? People bring, you know, a lot of debt financed companies out there. On the private side, I think where that becomes a challenge is, the private folks don't have to, you know, look every day to see kind of, you know, where the stock is trading and kind of how the industry is valuing themselves as well as, you know, all the other neighbors, if you will. And so sometimes there's a tendency, they're like, well, I'm still beautiful and you're ugly. And I think, you know, again, getting past that to say, well, okay, you know, if you were, you know, in a public market situation, how would you trade? And so I think that's a similar discussion to look at, again, what assets are, you know, both parties bringing to the table, and then what is the relative value of those assets as you start to think about what a combination could entail.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I would say the broader, no, I was just going to say that I think the broader thing that kind of like underpins all those things, which may be obvious, is like, does this make strategic sense, right? So when we think about, you know, what I just mentioned at the top in terms of large limited license states with, you know, high cultural significance, you know, those are the things that we look at in partners is, are people bringing those types of footprints that would be interesting, or maybe they have brands that are really interesting that we could deploy in New York and we think could, you know, kind of grow nationally, or maybe they have unique IP. And or unique know-how that could be interesting to accelerate either what we're doing in New York or becomes a great asset that could be used for, you know, future combinations.
Well, so let's dive into New York then. December 15th, just recently in 2022, you guys completed the final closing of that previously announced transaction with Etain. That's 4 dispensaries, a cultivation and production facility that went for approximately $42 million in cash and then another 5.2 million shares in RIV Capital. That's approximately 16% of outstanding RIV shares going to the former owners of Etain, which seems like a lot, especially when you compound inflation or the margin declines, you have retail price compression. How has RIV Capital's shareholders responded to the Etain deal so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhat hard to kind of parse out. I mean, I guess I would say one obvious thing, and again, that's public, is, you know, one of our shareholders actually sued us, didn't like the transaction. I was last April or May, I can't remember exactly when the lawsuit came across. And that was when we announced the deal and completed the first closing. So that individual wasn't happy. I think other folks that we've talked to, other shareholders that we've talked to, specifically large block shareholders, I think they weren't, you know, in hindsight, they're not happy with kind of the price paid, given the kind of both the collapse in both the kind of the broader equity markets, as well as the risk markets in cannabis. And so I think, you know, we've taken that feedback, and it, obviously you'd always like to pay less for something, but I think it doesn't kind of take us off, you know, kind of being bullish about the opportunity we see in New York. You know, there are challenges there with the way that the regulators are you know, kind of rolling out the regs and kind of the challenges or the speed with which they're moving. But we're working both kind of publicly as well as behind the scenes to try to offer up our assistance and our opinions on how we think we can make New York really kind of the shining example of kind of the most robust industry or state-based industry in the country.
Mm-hmm. That shareholder dispute you mentioned was with JW Asset Management. They were one of the larger shareholders of RIV Capital, controlling about 20%. They requisitioned a special meeting of shareholders for the purpose of replacing five of the seven directors. They said that the board at the time and management at the time failed to create value. I'm looking at RIV stock as both RIV and CNPOF on the OTC markets, and both happen to be down approximately 84% in the last 12 months. So with New York finally coming on board, what's your response to those skeptical investors looking at both RIV and CNPOF stock price?
Yeah, no, I think it's we definitely have kind of placed a bet in New York. And again, I think for the reasons that I've mentioned elsewhere or previously, I think it's a great opportunity. You know, conservative estimates of the current market in New York is $5 billion. Again, all that is illicit. And so really the work to be done there is for us to expand cultivation, which is what we're doing. Work with the regulators to get into the supply side as soon as possible, as well as on the retail side, and really start to steal market share from that illicit market, right? That's the similar kind of task at hand in any state once they flip to recreational, is you obviously have a robust illicit market, and New York has a very, you know, deeply rooted illicit market. I think the regulators are going to do their part, and they've told us that we should expect to see some increased enforcement over the next couple months. But really, it's going to be up to us, as well as, you know, all the people that are operating in New York on the legal side of the market, that we need to compete and win with the consumers, because ultimately, that consumer needs to choose to walk past kind of that that bodega that's selling, you know, kind of unlicensed product, and walk into a licensed retailer and buy that. And so much of that is about having the right products and the right brands on the shelf and giving consumers a great experience. So that's really the opportunity in New York, is to, you know, really capitalize on taking our fair share of that $5 billion market over the next, you know, 2 to 3 years.
And by bodega, you mean food truck? When I was out there in September, I think there was,
yeah, it could be anything.
Yeah. I think there's 30 food trucks that got confiscated in September when I was out in New York there the last time. What in your opinion, Mark, what is it going to take for RIV and other cannabis stocks to move independently of the news and one another? There is no fundamentals. There isn't even technicals within the cannabis industry. What is that going to take for that to happen?
Yeah, it's really challenging. I mean, I think you saw when there was just kind of the hope that safe banking would come, is, you know, a lot of folks were, you saw that all the equities move quite significantly, both from a volume as well as you know, price perspective. You know, and here we sit, and there's no kind of immediate macro catalyst that's going to kind of propel that. Propel those stock prices forward on that basis. I think, you know, my prediction for 2023 is I think we're going to see a lot of combinations. I think, you know, as I talk to other operators, I think the thought is, you know, how do you build a bigger armada to weather the storm? It's super fragmented industry, and there's a lot of synergies that could be had by combining, different organizations together to really kind of, you know, allow people to operate as leanly as possible, given the constrained capital environment that we sit in, given kind of the challenging equity situation that we're in, that people aren't going to want to issue a lot of equity at these prices. So I think that's one of the things that, you know, all the operators that I've talked to are focused on, is how do we kind of make moves today that are going to create long-term shareholder value, whether or not people realize it immediately, right? And so I think that's kind of the key, is, you know, a lot of folks are doing a lot of things that are, you know, either kind of streamlining their organizations, exploring different, you know, kind of combinations, all of which is to kind of make the company stronger. I don't know, to your point, given kind of technicals as well as people's kind of risk appetites, whether or not that's going to immediately get recognized. But I think once it does, I think you'll see kind of multiple expansion as well as, and I'm not putting a time frame on that, but you'd start to see multiple expansion and people really start to look at the fundamentals and, you know, the earning power of these different businesses.
So does part of that expansion include delivery? I was looking at a BDS analytics report that said Florida is the highest delivery demand state at 23%. So at, you know, 1 in 4 people wanting delivery, taking away from that retail experience, is that something that you're going to try to fight against that trend or incorporate?
No, I think it's definitely something you incorporate. I mean, if you think about, you know, so cannabis is just a product, right? When you think about the way that consumers, yourself, others around you consume products today, it's so much of it is, you know, built around convenience. And so if you can kind of lean into that and, you know, offer that convenience to the consumer that they can, you know, get their products the way that they want, when they want, I think that's the way to win with consumers, right? You give them not only a great experience with the product, but you give them a great experience with, you know, how they get the product.
Mm-hmm. You guys are, Etain is going to plan on developing and expanding new products and brands to try and resonate with that consumer in New York. Can you elaborate, being on the West Coast, I was in New York. It's really, really new, so I don't really know what that means. Can you elaborate on what resonates with New Yorkers right now and maybe what your expectations are on the overall New York market? I know you said $5 billion, that's going to match California. Maybe you can expand on that.
Yeah, so I guess I'll say two things. One is, interestingly, if you go into a lot of the bodegas, the unlicensed shops where they sell cannabis in New York, you're going to find a lot of California brands, and yeah, a lot of it is licensed California product. And that's a discussion for another podcast of how that stuff makes its way there. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, that kind of dovetails really well with kind of our initial hypothesis, which I probably talked about the last time, is, you know, we kind of the first part of our, you know, kind of strategy is to have these kind of large limited license states. The other part is, you know, we want to partner with operators that have shown an ability to operate at scale and compete and win in high competition states. So, you know, California, Colorado, Michigan, right? Those are states where, you know, there's a lot of competition, thousands of brands probably in California. So ones that have competed and won there, that says a lot, because that's a, you know, really kind of a precursor to the way that, you know, once all the walls come down, that's the way the market's going to operate, is it's going to be, you know, kind of the best brands and products win. And so really the discussions we've been having and we've talked about is, you know, working to bring some of those West Coast brands into New York. A lot of them are highly interested for the same reasons I talked about. There's a lot of folks, as well as when they think about trying to establish their brand on a national scale. If you are competing and winning in California and then competing and winning in New York, that goes a long way to establishing and saying that you're a national brand, right? So I think that's kind of one aspect. I think the other aspect is, you know, there are, you know, the Etain folks have a lot of great relationships with some of the kind of legacy brands in New York, not as big a scale as what, you know, folks operate at in California. But I think there's, you know, discussions to be had, with some of those brands as to whether or not they want to kind of come over to the license side. And so I think that's a big opportunity for us to capitalize on kind of those legacy New York brands and, you know, being complementary to the larger, more established kind of West Coast brands.
Any other predictions for 2023? If there's no regulations, BDS Analytics said that California followed by Texas, Florida, and then New York would be the biggest states. You have any response to that or any other predictions for 2023?
No, I mean, you know, that's, again, I think they're just, you know, if you count the number of people and, you know, what are the biggest states, you know, it's not hard to predict what are the biggest cannabis markets. You know, I recently read quite skeptically Schumer talking about the fact that he thinks, you know, he could get safe banking done this year. I just don't know that they're going to make it a priority. So I think everybody's kind of been burned on that more than once. So I think it's a believe it when we see it type situation. Mm-hmm. And then again, beyond what I mentioned earlier about kind of seeing a lot of combinations, I think that's going to be really the theme for this year of is consolidation.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think with that, we're going to have to roll this one up. So I want to thank my guest, Mark Sims, CEO of RIV Capital. You can find them on the Toronto Stock Exchange under RIV, as well as on the OTC under CNPOF. Where else can they find you at, Mark?
You can find our website, rivcapital.com.
Okay, perfect. I think with that, that's it. We're going to roll this one up. I'm Josh Kincaid. This is The Talking Hedge. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe, or don't, and I'm out.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
99.9% of our DNA is identical. It's a 0.1% that truly makes us different and unique. And that's what the show is about. Find out that 0.1% about your favorite guests. Find out what music they like, their first cannabis experience, and even what their room looked like growing up. But more importantly, or as important, their journey. Learn what makes them unique on Everything Is Personal.